You are listening to Jaya Ashmore. You can find hundreds of meditations and talks on my websites, jayaashmore.org, jayaashmore.org, as well as opendharma.org, opendharma.org. All the recordings are offered in the tradition of generosity or dana, and your gifts are welcome. Thank you for listening.
Who would like to ask or share anything? I didn't mean to do that. But I just landed on one person, as if I'm expecting. It was all a blur.
So, which is our tent love? And I think it just kind of has stayed as a question in my mind ever since. Or a mystery or something that I feel called towards. You were talking about, I believe it was around the time you were talking about going into.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty that happens and the change that happens with that attention and with offering, listening with dignity, offering dignity. And how, and I, all of that makes so much sense to me. And I oftentimes think about exploring my body as different parts of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And how, if
mm-hmm.
I can be with those parts, then that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And this distancing happens. This, I kind of like, yeah, some sort of distancing. But you said something about going below.
Yeah.
And that's the part that I
mm-hmm.
just wondering if you could speak to.
Yeah. So it's just a metaphor, but it. But nothing. It's a metaphor. I would be curious to hear more about the experience of feeling above. I can also just say really briefly what I talked about as going below yesterday was kind of maybe like being unarmed and being with the sort of groundedness of a wide okayness with the experience of something uncomfortable, painful. And so that's what I meant by below. Rather than above, the kind of distancing that's where I would be wanting to engineer some change, rather than being in life, participating in and unfolding. But when you, I'm curious if you feel like saying something a little bit more about your feeling of being in, and then there's an aboveness.
Yeah, I actually don't usually think about like why is it above.
Mm.
Sometimes I feel really merged with such an intensity of feeling. If there's a way
mm-hmm.
I can kind of think about
mm-hmm.
that can help me. That can help me distance myself from there.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be the same thing if we can really small. But I think I see what you were saying.
So, just the question would be for me: distance from it. In what way? What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
So. Until that point, we're saying the same thing, like having that there's discomfort in context.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, there's not only discomfort. And the discomfort doesn't equal the end of the world or something like that. And it's not just like taking over in the way that then the alarm system comes on and is all there is, seems to be all there is. And so it sounds like you might be saying distance from it so that there's space, that's not all there is. There's room for kindness, there's... but it could be interesting to feel if there's any other kind of distance that comes in that feels good because it gives me the illusion of some control or mastery that's not towards healing. That's towards separating, closeting. And then the thing is just that then we're losing some richness, some resources that are actually needed. And I think, I don't want to overstate or get involved in this sense of this time being specially, in all of history, the most momentous time ever, because I don't think that, I think that's part of our alarm system. further alarming itself. But I do think there is something about our times possibly like every other time, but I can feel this time that we're in now as we need all our resources to be handy and to be, you know, really flowing, feeding and flowing through. It's not really a time that we can just sort of keep a little, some boxes of stuff that isn't actually really fully needed right now. And I think there's a way that that's true generally in the spiritual path. That's really our discovery in the spiritual path, is that it's all needed, we're all needed. And how good is that? And so, and this is a little bit where we had a poem yesterday that's just above your, there, above your head there. oh yeah, you weren't, you also. So did you see that poem? Okay. The Lucille Clifton poem. If I were eloquent in your language, I would try to tell you how it is when something difficult loves you, or begins to love you, how it is when you begin to love it back, how this can cost you everything. And so I was saying yesterday that our elders bringing us forth to here, and where we are, and very appropriately always, our elders bring us to the edge, and our responsibility is what comes forth from here. It's not that they should have taken us further. They took us further. And now our responsibility comes. And I'm using that word knowing that it's a difficult word, responsibility. And that's part of our conundrum and work and discovery is the glory of growing up. That growing up is not a hassle or a drag, even though it's so demanding. And another way that I would like to talk about growing up and responsibility is with the word art. Because I think in general, coming especially to a deep rest retreat and the discovery of meditation through deep rest, or any practice that's helping relieve some of the pressure of our conditioning of trying too hard and pretending, and the inner critic, inner criticism. It is such a relief to hear and to partially believe, to be willing to take some baby steps, that aren't about pressure and trying too hard and pretending, while meanwhile postponing what's most important. It's such a relief that it's not about like making, you know, amping up the inner critic to make us work harder and do better and get there and then be ourselves. It's so relieving to hear that. But I think because we're still, it's like as if half our body is still in that machine and half our body is starting to come out and feel like some fresh air. And what is it like to just move? Not because someone told me to move my left arm like this 30 times, because that's, you know, experts say if you do it 30 times a day after lunch, you'll live longer or whatever. But half of us is maybe still involved in kind of negotiating with life. I'll be here if. If it's like this, then I'll be here. And so we misinterpret that real relief, that meditation practice is not a drag and a hassle. It's not about pain and heart. That's not what it's about. It includes, it accommodates, it does not exclude pain and hard work, but it's not about pain and hard work. And it's such a relief that then we think, oh, so people often will come on retreat. So funny. As I said yesterday, if we had 7 days, so usually at least 2 days, you'll be sleeping most of the time and hating me at least half of that time because you have a headache or, you know, I'm wasting your time or whatever. You could do this at home, but you couldn't, because you haven't. But anyway, it's not all that's happening either, as I mentioned yesterday. And it's so curious that right about when people start to get rested, there's this second, sort of secondary crisis point. And people start to have energy because they're rested, which is such a mystery that we take for granted. That by doing nothing, we would have energy. Like, why? We don't know. But people start to feel resentful that they think I've told them only to lie down always. And they start to feel like going for a jog or dancing or something. Why did Jaya tell us to always lie down? I didn't tell you to always lie down. Or they'll start to say, I don't know if I really understand because I'm trying to do that thing of not doing anything that you told me to do. You told me to do nothing. I'm like, I didn't tell you not to do anything. I never said do nothing. I might have said leave space and see what happens, or I might have said do less. Do so much less that something else, a qualitative shift happens. But I didn't say I didn't say just hang out there and let your habit energies take over. And so coming to an art, why would the art of being here be easier than any other art that we recognize as an art, playing the guitar? We don't expect to be good at guitar the first day. We don't expect to be better than everybody else at guitar after one lesson or 1 year or even 10 years. But we feel, you know, devastated when we find turbulence inside after all these hours or days or years or whatever amount of time you want to put in the blank. assuming that turbulence wasn't required in this art. So as we were quiet a few moments before talking now, I almost was laughing even before laughing. Just remembering a few times where I was so sure and upset that something was going wrong. And equally times that I was sure, you know, it was going so right. And then my teacher sort of just a little comment. So one time I was working with body scan. So just moving the attention through the body, which is part of that yoga that I mentioned in the movement today. After the shoulder stand, moving the attention through the body, down the arms, back up the arms, down the body and legs, and back up. And so I would be coming back up, and I couldn't get past here. Couldn't get past my middle. And I was so frustrated, and I had theories pretty soon about how it had to do with my mother and also some cultural things, misogyny and bras. And then it was like, click, this perspective shift of like, actually, how good that your attention has found the lower belly all by yourself. I didn't think of it as a discovery, I thought of it as a problem for months. And my teacher's a little bit hard that way, like letting me flounder a pretty long time so that it can be more often my own discovery. That there's a magnet here that wasn't there before. And just recently there were so many times I was just crying and crying and crying. There were reasons also, but not really knowing why so much. And it's even something culturally where people will ask, how are you, and is it easier now, or something like that. You know, wanting me to feel better, to have an easier time. And so then the tendency of kind of starting to try to package things towards, well, it was hard, but now it's better, or it's going to get better. Which is not always true. We actually don't know. Better in the conventional sense, that we do wish for each other that it would go better, be easier. And just before leaving India, kind of mostly unwillingly leaving India, but needing to leave India, last autumn, it was monsoon in Indian seasons, but our autumn. And my teacher basically sending me off with like, keep on crying, it's really good for you. Doing a lot of clearing with that. And so not like, oh, don't worry, it's gonna be all fine. Once you get back and settled in Spain, it'll be fine. It's like, that crying is really good for you right now. It's really clearing a lot. It hasn't been easy to keep on crying, being a single mom and all that. It's hard to find those times to let it all out. So if it comes to visit and it feels like it might be, you know, it's not that crying would always be for every person a clearing. Sometimes it's a repetition, and that's different. But when there's a clearing and tears come, hallelujah. So I'm not sure. I just check with you if I did. I finish my thoughts on all of that. Did we get to like? Did we get to the end of that rainbow? I think. So anyone else want to ask for Shane?
Difference between crying as release and as repetition. Mm. As I've had a lot of tears come up today, some quality of it that does feel like attachment to a woundedness.
Mm-hmm.
That I feel really ready to release, but like continues to reattach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like go deeper to where anything would feel the need to have the woundedness as a protection or as a whatever, as a strategy. Yeah, thank you. I don't know why, maybe because you're so quiet. My voice has been really quiet this time. I'm usually really loud. Sorry. Could you hear what she said? Okay. It just pops into my mind when I noticed that I said she instead of your name, that I record whenever I remember to all the sessions where there's talking. And so if there's any time before or after you would like to say something that you don't want it to be public someday, eventually through volunteers clearing the background static or whatever they do and then putting it up on the website, it's publicly available. Usually it could stop happening someday, but. So feel free to let me know if you want me to delete something that anyone has said, that you've said. Okay. So I was saying go deeper, meaning feeling for not just the really difficult discernment between what might be an attachment to woundedness or simply a flow of and letting go. Or how would you put, when it's not repetitive, how would you describe it?
I mean, it definitely feels like something flowing out in a way. And I think the kinds of tears that I was having today felt much more like drowning. Like, it felt much more like, being in a place that my system was like not okay with being.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of me wants to like, I have tools to like reground and soothe my system, but. Yeah, there's a question around like when to go deeper and when to like step
right.
back into resource and
mm-hmm.
spaciousness and
yeah.
when it feels that level of intense like, kind of like a terror.
Yeah.
System terror.
Yeah. So that's another interesting aspect of feeling the quality in terms of where coming into ground and resource and space, where that has any disconnect in it could be interesting, and where there could be space without disconnect from tenderness, or just modulating even more finely than you felt possible before, of having enough sense of, yes, you're not alone in this. This is not triggering a complete sense of isolation and abandonment and non-residence. But you're letting the rawness still be present, or an expression happen rather than muting an expression. But what I meant by deeper wasn't a necessarily intensification of emotion at all. What I meant was, so it's good, Cheryl, that you didn't hear me, so I can say this better the second time around. hopefully. So when I think you rightly named that repetition has to do with, you use the word being attached to woundedness. A typical language that I don't like very much, but anyway, is like identification with woundedness. and I think I'm gonna go with that, identification with woundedness, and we can go into the word. So if my identity rests upon the idea of being wounded, then when the wound starts to slide out from under me, it's so disorienting and dislocating. And then it can become interesting. What I mean by deeper is, from where is the need to hold on to the wound for protection, for as a billboard sign, like, I exist because I have this thing here that I know about and that, you know, has a sound, makes a sound. I'm grateful for how something happened for me when I first started to recover memories of sexual abuse in my childhood. The first person that I really found outside of myself to be with and to get help from, one of the very first things she said to me was, you're not always going to think of yourself as a survivor, and you're not always going to have a scar. And it was like, then we went into the work together. And I'm not saying that would be appropriate always for all people, but I felt like it was a really, almost like you might sort of bow at the threshold of a temple or something, like, okay, we're gonna go in and do this. And this is the entry point, is that this is not you. This is not what you are. This happened to you, and this happens. And it's grounding and uplifting, even though we don't expect it to be. It's exactly grounding and exactly spacious and uplifting. And even joyful in its own way. To find room for grief. To find room for that, like yesterday we talked about, because we care, not moving from the alarm system, because we care, like really seeing what has gone on, what has happened. And really seeing the not specialness of that, the personal, impersonal nature of our pain. And really seeing that, it's so not what we thought it would be. It is grounding and uplifting. And yeah, there's screams in there, and there's beating the ground. But the nature of our pain is to move on. I'm obviously not talking about bypassing. And it doesn't happen in one sweep. I mean, maybe, but really, basically, it doesn't. Just like there's those like four people in a billion that are happy with 4 hours of sleep. There's like those four people maybe in a trillion that in one sweep it's resolved or whatever. We found ourselves enriched. And uplifted, not by the wound, but by life. Not only despite the wound, but through it. And it's almost horrible to even have that thought. Because we're so afraid that it would be inviting further wounding or in any way condoning violence. It's so close. But I think that the painfulness does, at some point, ask us to feel like, if in any way I'm holding back or holding on as a trick to the pain, because it's painful, if in any way I'm holding on to it, let me see the trick. Let me see my hypocrisy. Let me see the way I'm using that, the violence of using pain in any way that's not necessary. That's, well, I mean, using it wouldn't be necessary. But we get there when we get there also. So it's not, we can't engineer that leverage, but it is possible by feeling the painful as painful to fall deeper and to be unwilling to perpetuate. And what helps that is the wide and the resource, which is really about friendliness and not freaking out, so stability. And that means inner and outer, friends, actual people, being in the presence of actual people, and being that person in, multiple multiple persons inside. In the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, at night, while we're asleep, while we're awake, while we're dreaming. And that's part of the art. So when we're ready, like, oh, it's such a relief to come out from under that cumbersome, harsh, criticism as a motivating force and as a guiding and as a leadership. Oh, good, now we don't have to do anything, is our assumption, because we're still half in there in the sort of reward punishment machine. But when we sort of fall out of the machine, we fall out of our willingness to perpetuate pain unnecessarily. To perpetuate pain is unnecessary. And when we fall out of it for even a moment, I think we find we're in our willingness, which we could call responsibility. In our willingness, which has the humbleness I mentioned yesterday, that because it's willingness to be moved. Willingness to wait to be moved. And to be ready to be moved. And so it's not like, whatever, doesn't matter. Because there's no disciplinarian, doesn't matter. Jaya doesn't care, she won't get mad at you, do whatever. And that's true, and I'm not gonna be mad at you. Why would I be mad at you? But we can see the violence of that. Those patterns that we indulge in or are compelled in. And we expect that if we're seen, like if we're caught at some, we're caught at it, we expect punishment and sometimes project that. And then when there isn't, we're like, oh, I got away with something. That part is still active a bit longer. And then it gets boring. Is untrue. And so we start to find, in this edge that we find ourselves on, where it's open-ended in front of us. And what are we going to do? Are we going to be obedient to violence? Are we going to be so relieved that it's not about violence that we just kind of, whatever? Or is it possible to feel that it's not that we're going to get in trouble, but to start to realize that it matters. It makes a difference if your hand is facing up or your hand is facing down. It matters when you say that thing that you feel your intuition to say it. It matters. And even a few seconds later than when your heart was just like bubbling, and a few seconds later, it mattered. But you're not in trouble. And even though it might be a bit more messy, we start to find that mess is what we're kind of, those are the, that's the ingredients we have to make art with, to make food with. And what there isn't really time and energy for is to go back and be like, oh no, why didn't I just say it when I wanted to say it? And because my mother and the bra, you know. So I'd like to read another poem. And just, I found that often Dharma talks on retreats are not so much like a one talk and then another talk, but the three talks are all one conversation. And so this is not a shorter poem. And it's also a poem that I've read many times. And I just find it's the poem of Wendell Berry's that right now feels like is a good example of the elders bringing us here, and now what? And so feeling like, okay, where exactly have they brought us? They brought us really far, and also where haven't they gone? It wasn't their job to do, you know, but we can start to feel, and also, well, I'll read the poem first, actually. So it's one of the Sabbath poems from the year I first went to India, 1987. Coming to the wood's edge on my Sunday morning walk, I stand resting a moment beside a ragged, half-dead wild plum in bloom. Its perfume, a moment enclosing me. And standing side by side with the old, broken, blooming tree, I almost understand. I almost recognize as a friend the great impertinence of beauty that comes even to the dying, even to the fallen, without reason, sweetening the air. I walk on, distracted by a letter accusing me of distraction, which distracts me only from the 100 things that would otherwise distract me, from the whiteness, lightness, sweetness in the air. The mind is broken by the 1,000 calling voices it is always too late to answer. And that is why it yearns for some hard task, lifelong, longer than life, to concentrate it and to make it whole. But where is the all-welcoming, all-concentrating Sabbath that would do the same? Where the quietness of the heart and the eye's clarity? Sorry. That would be a friend's reply to the white blossoming plum tree. And so the question that the poem ends with is where we're left with. He completely tells it like it is, in a way that is, you know, I haven't found really another poet that tells that like that is. especially the part about where we would naturally, through our distraction, be looking for something hard to make us feel whole. And then even coming to that brink of, okay, but what about the friend's reply? And I think that's exactly our question. What would be our friend's reply? To something that is sweetening the air without reason. Not because it's like for now just born or it's half dead and still blooming, which is almost all we need from the poem. Just that. And so it's like with gratitude and reverence for where our elders have brought us. Like without complaint. But also without not seeing what they didn't see. And there's just, and so it's like how to even have the language. And that's also what's before us. How to have the language. It's part of the art. So just at the end, yesterday I talked about this word prophet or prophecy, and pro is like being before, being in front of. And then fet or fessi in the Indo-European root would be bha, which in Hindi nowadays, even now, bhasha is language. What is language? What is, and then, okay, here we are at the brink of an open-endedness. We stand before it, it stands before us. It lies before us, it spreads before us. An open-endedness, an emptiness, an unanswered question. And then what language and what is language when we stand before that or when that lies or spreads before us? And isn't that language a coming down out of the cerebral and even the cognitive? Yesterday, I just mentioned, what is it like, for example, in the meditative movement or any meditation where we're actually just disengaging from the frameworks of right and wrong. We're disengaging from ideology. We're disengaging from if and but. And there's a fear that's the end of the earth and we're going to fall off. And there's also a knowing that it isn't. And what kind of knowing is it? It's not pre-known, pre-conceived, pre-figured out. It's not an agreement between equals. It's not even an agreement between unequals where the landlord gives us the contract and we sign. We're so much more humble than that. We have so much, in a way, less say about what we're in the midst of. And so the moments where we feel frustrated or angry with ourselves, disappointed with ourselves. We had hoped that after all these years or hours of meditation, we would be over fearfulness or shame. And it's such a hubris. that it's funny. And I think that finding the funny bone in it is one of the important parts of our art. It doesn't mean it's not utterly serious and life or death for many creatures, not only our own body. But finding the funny bone, you know, if we could just, like, it still hurts, I know. When, again, so Claudia's example yesterday of bracing and your own example of your own kind of bracing, it's probably something, some kind of tension in the body is an expression of a lifelong conversation that we could be more in. Conversation that we could be more in, receptive, rather than talking at. What would be a friend's reply? And then the nature of friendship in our art. So instead of a contract between equals or unequals, but it's a deal we made, you know, you signed. I find that we try to negotiate. We keep on trying to negotiate. And it's there's just so much that's unnegotiable. And so why waste our time? It takes time and patience to come into the reality of what we're in the midst of. And the horrors of that, the demands of that, and then the sweetness of that. Like, what? There's beauty with the terror. And is it an insult or is it not an insult that the beauty is more lasting? That the beauty has a taste of something beyond time, and the wound doesn't. So we keep trying, maybe it's like learning to ride a horse or whatever, like we keep falling off. And gradually we're like, I keep falling off, but let's get rid of this saddle, you know, that's in between me and the horse. And then what does that mean about getting on the horse? Like, does the horse want you on it? When the horse wants you on it, and then what conversation is that, and what ride is that? And so what I feel a little bit in the poem of today is really interesting next to what I find a little bit missing in the poem of yesterday. So what I find a little bit missing in the poem today is, well, he's a white man. And even, so he's just, and again, this is like not criticism in the way that we would think of literary criticism or even like, the elders didn't do us right or whatever, like, with so much gratitude and reverence for what comes through a poet, you know, which is a prophet, which is letting language happen, standing before what seems to be nothingness. We could feel maybe for some hints of what I would like to suggest. The great impertinence of beauty that comes even to the dying, even to the fallen. I think we can hear the non-acknowledgement that we're all dying and we're all fallen already. And so it's something of maybe too much separation between the lightness and the whiteness and the brightness and the sweetness and the brokenness and the dead and the already fallen. And we could even be like the stinkiness. And then just having that next door to Lucille Clifton. And so as a white person, speaking about the poetry of an African-American woman, it's with even more hesitation and the same reverence and gratitude. But I still feel that it's worth pointing what I feel that she's left us with, just the rawness of it could cost you everything. Which is a really good place to leave us. And so it's not that she should have left us somewhere else, but like where we could go from there. And having permission, like asking permission to go from there. It could cost you everything. It can cost you everything. It does cost you everything. Hallelujah. That, like feeling that even though it's a cost, that life intrinsically it wants, it demands, it requires, it takes everything. There could be the glorious willingness to give it. To give everything. And to be made whole in that. Giving everything. Even though I would have, if it was just up to me, I would have like, I'll give you this today and maybe that, maybe tomorrow, and I'm going to keep this for me and I'm going to ignore that forever. And again, I feel like it's just a slight membrane, a separation between the shit and the inspiration. And I just wonder if maybe now we could really get in to what's shitty. Exactly in a way that's grounded and grounding and like, wow, I'm even more in than I ever thought could be. Like I'm really in here. I can feel the earth through the building. As part of the art of facing emptiness, facing what hasn't come forth yet, being present before. So what older traditions might have called God and emptiness. And I think we don't yet have a name for now for what this experience is. Except maybe we talk about emergence. We have an experience of as if out of nowhere something happens. And that something happening is exactly like where the rawness, the stinky, the shit, what we would have used to call darkness, and then what we used to call lightness, brightness. Like, have each other in an embrace. That could be love, if that word survives the transition. But it's love in a way that's, yeah, okay, fulfilling, threatening to our so far still fragile willingness to be here. Who, me? that good and that bad, that good and that hard, that powerful and that sweet, that lightning. In me. That's rough precision. And everything that we thought precision was going to be is all a chaos, collapse, mess. And everything we thought about that was messy, that we thought it was messy, we start to recover. The exact timing, the exact form, the exact quality that it has. So, like my tears that I thought I was going to get better soon, don't worry. Or pretty soon I was going to find my way from here to finish my body scan. And then so what? Are there any questions or anything, any comments or anything to share that could be for today or for continuing on tomorrow? So even if it's a big question or a big share, just doesn't have to be like that we're gonna snap it shut in one instant.
I really like how you keep the ways of permission. When you talk about our elders, feeling that's just a point, I've often thought about that, and continue to think about that, is having been given permission to do things in a certain way that previously we weren't given permission to do.
Mm-hmm.
And all the gratitude that I have for that. And that there's, but that we now need to give permission, both to ourselves and to those.
Mm-hmm.
Us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so exciting and so scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, I think you learn that, but you don't, really, yeah, it really comes to the other thing, you know, the
mm-hmm. We don't learn that at all because it's a completely different mode. Like, we learn the transactional. The parents gave us life, so what do we owe them? And what is another way that's not just like rejection of the parents? Or at best, like, thank you for the gift of life, goodbye. So we don't even, much less, like, how to graciously pass on that place at the brink. But I wouldn't let you off the hook yet. I think there's much creativity to go forth from who is alive now altogether, as well as including leaving room for people who are younger or who may be younger in that way, that they're ready to go further ahead, so to speak, venture further out into the open-endedness. I'm just thinking of the word reciprocity and I can't remember, Steve Jenkinson, is that his name, the grief walker? This Canadian guy, I think he's still living, who helps people embrace death when it's time. And the person who made the movie about him, that's called Grief Walker, is kind of an acquaintance friend, it seems like, who was near death in a hospital, I think because of a mistake in the hospital, or at least it was an unexpected, it was like a routine surgery, and then it wasn't anymore a routine surgery, so he was near death. And Steve kind of walked into the hospital with whatever sort of beaver pelts and other things from his, I don't know what accoutrement of his First Nations traditions He's not a First Nations person, as far as I know, but that's some of his spiritual tradition. And did something or other, or allowed something or other to come through, and the friend recovered soon after. And they talk about it. At first, I think the friend is sort of like in denial, and then gradually realizing, I got my life back. And so in the film, they also have a conversation on film, the filmmaker with the grief walker. So about like, so you got your life back. What are you gonna do? And it's not, okay, you owe me, Steve Jenkinson, something. You don't, in a way, owe anything, because that's a different language and mindset. But still, what are you going to do? Now that your life is like doubly a gift. And I feel like if we could just go deeper in the sense of, well, we don't need to come near death and come back from near death to be in the same position, the exact same position. What are you going to do with the gift of life? And he uses the word reciprocity, and talking in some of the native traditions, there's still that sense of before taking, there's an offering. And this possibility of, with reverence and gratitude, asking permission to go forth from here. Not just preserving a tradition, but being part of a living tradition, a lineage that lives on. And is not loyal, it's not about loyalty to the form and structure only, or primarily. In some traditions, that's really important, that the structure is honored. And still, even when we, this is another thing that's part of what you're saying we haven't learned, is accepting limitations, and the paradox of accepting, here we are, we don't know what's going to happen in the next moment or the next moment. This open-endedness that we're, here we are on the brink of it. And what is the friend's reply? With gratitude, with reverence, and accepting the gift of life, there's a kind of confidence that we also don't have. Where we can accept limitations humbly, in a way that's not, see, it's interesting, we even talk about being small as a negative thing. So recovering being small as a positive thing. My elders are huge, compared to how small I am, okay? So small in a great way, I love that. But not in a contracted or demeaned way. It's not as an held back way. And if we can really start to get, and this is maybe almost the crux of our art, is accepting the limits. Doesn't mean there's not also the equally demanding part of our art of staying true to the nearly infinite possibilities that still honor the limits. So even if, I mean, we could just go to like really present day obvious conundrums, like even though it's clear we can't continue to use fossil fuels in the way that we are, it doesn't mean we can't, it doesn't necessarily mean the end of travel. It might even be probably would be some much better kind of travel, and maybe in many ways, inner travel, outer travel. So even if we would only find there's three colors that we want to paint with, or that the tradition allows, or whatever way it comes, whatever way the limits come. There's infinite paintings that come from three colors. Okay, that's more than enough for me.